beloved companion of more than 20 years? Why should you be troubled by an attachment formed before you met? Did he think my resentments were petty jealousy? Like a new bride enraged to discover her husband had once danced with a pretty girl at a ball. I, too, had formed attachments before I met Alexander Hamilton. But I did not feel guilty or disloyal for them, nor did I wish Lafayette to think me petty. I'm troubled because I wasn't beloved. I've read the old letters, and they've poisoned everything. A good-hearted girl, not a genius, not a beauty. I could recite them line for line, but I told Lafayette only as much as I could bear, feeling diminished with every word I repeated. When I was finished, Lafayette rubbed at his face.
It is regrettable, what haunted people we are, you and I.
I stood, trembling, aghast at my indiscretion in matters that I feared must have seemed to him quite trivial. And now there was nothing to do but pray his pressing engagements would soon force a merciful end to our conversation. But Lafayette led me to a bench by the church doors and settled into it, as if he meant to stay with me a while. He patted the bench.
Please, we are both of an age now when we must sit.
Suddenly tired and unimaginably weary, I sank beside him in silent mortification. Meanwhile, he cast a serene gaze across the cemetery.
We are also of an age when we live in the past. We speak to old ghosts more real for us than the strangers of this new age who pass us on the street, yes? We try in vain to crawl into letters and memories for the comfort of those who cannot talk to us any longer.
Renewed shame washed over me.
I shouldn't have troubled you.
You have a saying in France? He interrupted. L'habit ne fait pas le moine. The robe does not make the monk. Do you understand?
No, I said, still trembling with humiliation.
It means that the way things are clothed is not always as they are. Are you so modest, madame, that it has never occurred to you that the letters Hamilton wrote you were the sincere ones?
I took a deep breath as I digested his implication that Alexander had deceived Lawrence, not me. Lafayette cleared his throat and rested his top hat on his knee.
If this has not occurred to you before, I can only think it is because of a delicate subject yet to be mentioned. Bah! What we do to women?
I brought my hands to my face, with fear of what he might say next.
My friend has left you haunted by some notion that he did not love you. And you see you in this state. I am now haunted by the idea I may have given my wife the same doubts. A husband at 16? What did I know? But there were other women even when I was old enough to appreciate what I had in a wife.
Oh, no, I said, wanting him to stop talking. I willed him to stop talking. But Lafayette was never a man easily silenced.
In America, a mistress is scandal. In France, expected. In my mind, having nothing to do with my love for my wife, I am certain it was the same for my friend.
I gasped softly, my stomach clenching at the realization he was defending my husband. And all I could hear was my sister's words, "All husbands stray." The memory made me so angry I snapped, "I am long acquainted with these justifications."
You mistake my purpose. I only mean to say that though a man might cause misfortune and pain to his loved ones, he can still love them. I spent 5 years in a dungeon, convinced I would die there, and yet I did not actually know what it was to be unhappy until I lost my wife. That is how completely I loved her. My friend Hamilton loved you the same way.
You cannot know that.
How can I not know how he felt about you after 1,000 intimate conversations? Lafayette shifted toward me. I am grateful to speak for a man who spoke for me when I was imprisoned, and could not speak for myself. But what I say only echoes the voice inside you that already knows from a lifetime of kisses and tender proofs that Hamilton belonged to you. Hear me when I say there was never a person, not a soldier, coquette, or femme fatale, that he ever spoke of with such devotion or besotted passion as he spoke of you to me.
Oh, how dangerous were his words. Believing them would only lead to disappointment. No man could have been devoted to and besotted by me and taken my sister as a mistress. Except, perhaps, for one man, said that accursed inner voice that Lafayette had summoned. Needy, insecure Alexander Hamilton, who could never forgo an impulse or resist the affections he'd been starved of as a child. And while these thoughts battered me, Lafayette took the liberty of resting his aged hand upon mine.
Maybe it is impossible to forgive. This I understand. But I beg of you, remember that our dear Hamilton was not a man to govern his emotions. It was not in his nature. If ever you felt his love, it was real. Because to pretend at hate or friendship or love is possible for some men, but not for Hamilton. For him, impossible.
This I couldn't deny. And Lafayette was, I realized, still a resourceful general. He'd somehow stolen inside my inner fortifications and brought them down. And now my defenses were left in smoldering ruins, leaving me only to retreat. You are too loyal a friend.
I take this for a compliment, madame.
Sniffing and remembering a long-ago conversation with Hamilton, I shook my head. I'm not sure that I meant it as one.
Yet I take it anyway,
Lafayette replied.
Did I not sometimes find myself being angry with Hamilton, making within my heart a ridiculous fight between love and anger, and wishing for him to behave more sensibly? Oui, he was no perfect man, but he was a great one. It is only plain justice that his wife should remember him better, and his country, too.
Chapter 42 Lafayette was the guest of the nation, and despite my repeated demurs, he was determined to win me to his side. The general's campaign began the next morning when Georges delivered to us a handwritten invitation to attend the grand festival at the castle garden, along with a gift of a book by Fanny Wright, an advocate for women's rights and abolitionist school reformer who was traveling in Lafayette's entourage. Clasping the book and the invitation with equal delight, Lisbeth cried, "Can we go, Mama?" I didn't relish the inevitable crowds, but it wouldn't do for me to be seen holding myself aloof from a celebration of Lafayette to which he'd specifically invited me. Besides, I wanted to make my daughter smile. But when I told her we could go, her smile fell away. "Oh, but I have nothing to wear." My Lisbeth, who'd never come out properly into society, possessed a wardrobe that consisted entirely of drab workaday calicoes and one fancier brocaded gown for church. Her whole life, my Lisbeth had patiently forborne the money spent to educate her brothers and the attention paid to her troubled sister. She wasn't the oldest or the youngest, and therefore had often been lost in the shuffle. But she was the daughter I'd always wished for, and she deserved a ball gown. It was far too late to employ a seamstress. There wasn't a tailor or sewing girl in the city, not feverishly engaged in last-minute alterations for the forthcoming ball. But inside a very old and neglected trunk, I found a beguiling gown made of blue satin with a golden belt, embroidered in the pattern of a Greek key. "It was your Aunt Angelica's," I said, unwrapping it. It was the gown my sister had worn to our dinner party at the Grange, not long before Hamilton's death, and it was now 2 decades out of style. I'd saved it, even when I'd wanted to burn every token of every person who ever hurt me, because when I'd burned Monroe's kerchief, it had seemed almost to do him too much honor. Nevertheless, I expected that the sight of the dress would pain me deeply, as all reminders of my sister now did. But when my daughter pulled the gown against herself and twirled, a different emotion rose in my breast. For the dress flattered Lisbeth to the point of transformation, revealing the natural beauty she usually hid behind seriousness and spectacles. Instead of pain, I felt nothing but my daughter's joy. And that now seemed to be a wonderful gift, one my sister had made possible. "Oh, but the beadwork and embroidery," Lisbeth suddenly fretted. "It's too much for a dedicated spinster. Too much for me, by far." "It's exactly right," I said, taking up my needle. It had been years since I'd dedicated much time to my sewing, and doing it now in the service of my daughter's happiness seemed the best cause. "We shall make it a perfect fit." And when that was accomplished, I retrieved for Lisbeth an ancient pair of blue paste earbobs to match. Earbobs that made me remember that whatever Angelica had done or been, she'd also been my touchstone, always finding small ways to support and embolden me, as I now wished to support and embolden my daughter. As for me, my own formal attire was greatly simplified by virtue of widowhood. I owned one black gown proper for such an occasion, scented by the cedar chips with which it had been stored. Thus, donning a bonnet and the pearl-encrusted pendant in which Washington's hair was enclosed, I braced myself to return to society. We went by carriage to the battery from whence my husband first stole British cannons and made his reputation at the start of the Revolution. The bridge to the castle garden was covered with rich carpets from one end to the other. In the middle of the bridge arose a pyramid 65 feet high, lit with colored lamps and surmounted by a brilliant star in the center, which blazed the name Lafayette. And then we stepped into the magnificent entryway to find a vast amphitheater inside the circle of the old fort, containing at least 1,000 torches and nearly 6,000 persons. An eager crowd jostled Lisbeth and I beneath an arch formed of the flags of all nations, surmounted by a colossal statue of Washington. I expected always to encounter the father of the nation at any celebration, but I didn't expect to find a richly decorated marquee ornamented upon a platform with a bust of my husband and 2 pieces of cannon taken at Yorktown. "It's Papa!" Lisbeth cried with a breath of astonishment, as if she'd never expected or dared to hope to see her father honored outside of our intimate circle of family and friends. And my heart ceased to see her hands go to her mouth, as if to contain her surprise and joy. Had Lafayette arranged for this display? And was it meant for the crowd, or for me? He was not a perfect man, but he was a great one. It is only plain justice that his wife should remember him better, and his country, too. I was still not convinced by Lafayette's argument, even as a murmur rushed through the crowd around us. "It's Mrs. General Hamilton!" The whispers rose like the murmur of the sea, and Lisbeth clutched my hand. "Everyone's staring." They were, and I met their gazes, each and every one. And what I saw reflected back at me, after so many years out of the public eye, was a pleasant surprise. Admiration, curiosity, and without question, respect. In that moment, a curly-haired officer in uniform and sash bumped into us so hard that Lisbeth would have fallen if he hadn't caught her by the waist.
"Oh, dear, I am so very sorry," he said, looking not a bit sorry.
Forgoing all protocol that might have required a gentleman should be introduced, he presented himself as one Lieutenant Sidney Holly. We returned the introduction, forced as we were to it, and the young man's cheeks reddened.
Hamilton?
With wide eyes, he glanced at the bust, then back at us, seeming so discomforted that I thought he must be a rabid Republican, but then he said,
I dare say I wouldn't have employment without your father's innovations, Miss Hamilton. I work as a customs inspector.
Is that so? My daughter said, smiling shyly. Awkwardness hung between them, and he finally gave a little bow.
If you'll excuse me, he said, apologizing again and again.
That poor man, Lisbeth said once he'd gone. There's no cause for him to be so embarrassed for an accident. That was no accident, I said, explaining what she'd have known if she'd attended as many balls as I had. Bumping into a young lady is an old trick employed by young men lacking the means of obtaining a proper introduction. He's embarrassed because, upon hearing your father's name, he realized he blundered quite above his station.
Truly?
Lisbeth said, her eyes widening in apparent delight at his impudence. She turned to smile much less shyly in the direction of the man's retreat. Just then, Lafayette appeared to the tune of See the Conquering Hero Comes. We found our seats, and the cloths that surrounded and enclosed the hall rose like a curtain at the theater to reveal the pure and brilliant moon shining on the harbor, upon which steamboats were plying in every direction. Several times that magical evening, dances were attempted, but every time Lafayette approached them, the dancers broke off and came to group themselves around him. Young ladies swooned when he kissed their hands upon introduction, and he obliged them all, except for one girl, who presented a gloved hand which he refused.
"Your pretty glove is stamped with my face, mademoiselle, and I am not so egotistical that I can kiss myself."
When the laughter died down, mothers presented their children, and asking his blessing, feeble old men reanimated in talking to him of the numerous battles in which they'd been engaged with him for the sake of liberty. Free black men reminded him of his philanthropic efforts to place them in the rank, which horrid prejudices still denied them. And young men whose hard and blackened hands announced their laborious occupations stopped before him and said,
"We also belong to the 10 millions who are indebted to you for liberty and happiness."
Despite all the Republicans had done to ruin the country, I couldn't help but be a little stirred by the plain evidence of how many of my fellow Americans now thrived. Before long, Georges made his way through the throngs of well-wishers, sharing with him their admiration for his father to seek us out.
"We wish to know if you and your mother will be pleased to share the berth across from our own, Miss Hamilton."
"A berth?" Lisbeth asked, her nose pink from just a few sips of champagne.
"On the steamboat?" Georges said, tilting his head. "We depart just after midnight."
Lisbeth pulled her shawl around her in bewilderment.
"Where to?"
Now Georges was equally bewildered.
"My father says you are to accompany us on our journey up the river."
At this, my daughter gasped with delight, as of course Lafayette knew she would. What a wily man. Annoyed that the Frenchman should still be so sly as to wield my daughter's excitement against me, I said, "I fear your father has misunderstood, Georges. We cannot join you." Lisbeth had perhaps sipped more champagne than I realized, because she put a hand to her hip and demanded to know, "Why not?" Why not, indeed. At the age of 67, I didn't go anywhere after midnight, much less on a journey up the Hudson. But before I could say as much, the old hero stole upon us and laughed.
"She asks, why not? Spoken like a Lafayette. Come with me, ladies, at least as far as West Point."
"General," I began, aware of what felt like 6,000 pairs of eyes now fixed upon us, "we are honored by your invitation and generous attention, but the hour grows so late."
"We accept,"
Lisbeth interrupted me with extraordinary impertinence. Gladly.
Lisbeth, I hissed.
Something had come over my daughter. I didn't know if it was the ball gown, the idea of further conversation with her curly-haired beau, or seeing the bust of her father. Whatever the cause, Lisbeth grabbed my hand.
Wouldn't my father go with Lafayette, and since he cannot, shouldn't we?
Of course her father would go. Alexander, the hero of Yorktown, would have every right, in justice, to ride in glory beside Lafayette. To deny it would be to deny his children the recognition and honor they craved all their lives. The cruelty of the world had denied them this. How could I deny it to them, too?
Ah, I see I have it wrong,
Lafayette said with a mischievous wink.
She is a Hamilton through and through.
Outflanked by the pair of them, I threw up my hands.
But we have nothing packed.
Lafayette made an elaborate twirling gesture with his hand.
And what of it? When we were young, you climbed into a sleigh with only a satchel and drove off with me into the wilderness.
This memory was a warm and delightful one. It was also a story my daughter didn't know. As Lafayette told it, he made me remember the young and adventurous woman I used to be. And quite unexpectedly, I yearned for her.
So I beg you, Lafayette said, come with me tonight.
Despite his words, Lafayette was not begging. He was issuing a command. And though I had defied victorious generals before, I didn't have the heart to resist or resent him for it. Especially when Lisbeth looked happier than I'd ever before seen her, and multitudes clamored for the opportunity to take my place. Drunk on champagne and celebration, the whole city wished to climb aboard Lafayette's steamship and chug away with him. And so, quite irregularly and recklessly, that is exactly what we did. That night, a great number of prominent citizens, unwilling to part with Lafayette, crowded onto the ship deck with us until the captain was forced to refuse even one more. Then, to a setting moon, we lost sight of the castle garden amidst the noisy cadence of the steam machinery, struggling against the waves and current of the river. The river that tied me to my past. Though the steamboat contained more than 80 beds, the crowd had not been foreseen, and the greater part of the men slept upon the deck. Nevertheless, I don't believe any of us slept much, because every few minutes cannons announced our passage by some village. So at sunrise, I abandoned my berth and went above deck to enjoy the view of the majestic banks of the Hudson. I was at Lafayette's side when a group of old Revolutionary soldiers gathered at the rail, sharing stories from their service.
There I wept for an enemy,
Lafayette said, pointing to the spot where he'd sat in court-martial over the British spymaster, Major André, and seen him hanged. And I knew, should we keep chugging north, we'd pass Sugarloaf Mountain and the house on the shoreline from whence Benedict Arnold fled to the British Army, my husband in desperate pursuit. I heard the word traitor murmured by more than one man, and I nearly murmured it myself, remembering that I was with Arnold when I met Lafayette, though I hadn't thought of that day in years. Now those harrowing times of the war came back to me. Names of towns and soldiers and battlefields in this valley stirred memories for me, too. Fort Ticonderoga, the loss of which cost my father his command. Saratoga, where Burgoyne burned our home to the ground before being forced to surrender. Albany, where Loyalists broke into my father's home and nearly chopped us with a hatchet. New Windsor, where Alexander and I first lived as newlyweds, and where I learned the story of Captain Molly. I had not, like Captain Molly, taken up arms or shed blood in the cause. But I'd stitched up and cared for those who did.
I'd traveled with Washington's army and shared some of its privations, and I imagined myself in fraternity with these brother soldiers, looking out upon the country we'd brought into being. And to my astonishment, I felt as if I belonged with them on this journey after all. As if to banish any doubt, Lafayette said,
"When I first came to this valley, I found the high mountains, with their thick forests and naked rocks all along this river, so imposing. It was difficult not to share the superstitious terror of the Indians. Unless, of course, one has a Schuyler at his side. As I did then, and now."
I warmed at his praise and the way it earned me the deference of our fellows. And as the sun glinted off the river that day, dazzling my eyes with its brilliance, I realized how the country had grown past the wilderness of my youth under the rule of the British crown. Everywhere I looked, new towns and modern wharves grew up, all peopled by two generations who'd come of age thinking of themselves as Americans. And despite my anger and disappointments, my heart swelled with pride. Pride and love of country. Could I truly still feel such a thing? In seeking his oblivion, my husband had wrapped himself in his patriotism, thereby diminishing mine. Then Jefferson, Burr, Madison, and Monroe had buried my family, captured my government, and claimed its flag. But it didn't belong to any of them more than it belonged to me, and I should never have allowed them to steal it away. For they might be fathers of this unruly and flawed nation, but surely then I'd been one of its mothers. As if sensing some change in me, Lafayette leaned in and pointed to the aft railing.
"Shall I stand in Hamilton's place and take up my ancient sword in defense of your daughter's virtue?"
I turned and frowned to see Lisbeth in the crowd, flirting with Lieutenant Holly from the night before. That impudent young man nearly toppled her into a tray of champagne at the ball just to secure an introduction. Lafayette chuckled.
"And yet, she is taken with him. It seems your daughter is very much like you."
A fool for a man in uniform? Yes, I suppose so.
I was going to say, a woman with a forgiving heart?
I stared at the presumption of his implication, and he actually laughed.
"Forgive my friend, Hamilton,"
Lafayette said, as if he'd sensed the softening in me toward the man without whom, I suppose, I could never have become what I was.
"You see how, everywhere I go, people press gifts into my hands? Weapons, jewelry, Indian artifacts, things of great value to them? So why not give me this gift of forgiving Hamilton?"
I peered around us, but no one paid any mind to our intimate exchange. "You take advantage, General." He shrugged, incorrigible.
"I cannot help myself, madame. After spending so many years in a prison, my mind becomes sharp to the things that truly matter in this world."
And Hamilton mattered. We didn't have time to say more when another round of cannons fired as the steamboat docked for a day of ceremonies at West Point, where I would be Lafayette's honored guest. Below, crowds shouted, "Long live Liberty! Long live Lafayette! Honor to Lafayette! Honor to him who fought and shed his blood for the peace and happiness we enjoy!" With a wave, Lafayette shouted back,
"Honor to Hamilton, too!"
I put a hand upon his arm to stop him, but he only patted it.
"He should be honored, as should you. Travel with me, madame. I like seeing this country with you, and I am to go west."
West. Even at my age, I was still unexpectedly tantalized by the idea. As tantalized as the first time Lafayette asked me to go off with him into the wilds. And he must have sensed it, because he pressed his advantage.
"I will pass through the Oneida homeland. Together, we can call upon some of our old comrades. We shall visit Grasshopper and Two Kettles together."
I was taken by surprise that he did not know, that no one had told him, that he would not find many Oneida left in the world. Grasshopper had passed away long ago. Two Kettles Together only recently. And the Oneida nation had dwindled. Despite all they'd done for the nation during the revolution and federal treasuries recognizing their service, the state government had all but defrauded the people of the Standing Stone of their lands. So I explained as gently as I could, very few Oneida still reside amongst us. Like the rest of the Iroquois, they've been forced to migrate. Lafayette's usually sunny expression fell into such grave disappointment that I felt ashamed. Perhaps he was remembering how our time with the Oneidas changed the course of the war. Perhaps he was remembering his own role in helping to negotiate the Treaty of Fort Stanwix that secured the Oneida their lands. Whatever the thoughts in his mind, I knew he was one of the few persons present who cared about the fate of our allied Indians, and even those who'd been our enemies.
"Then it is good we go west," Lafayette finally said. "Perhaps we will see the Oneida there. We may travel as far as the wilds of Illinois."
"Two Kettles Together's son is in the Illinois Territory," I said, musing on the idea. "And so is my son, William." I smiled at the notion of adventure and of seeing William again, because I realized that I was not only capable of the trip, but also interested, for the first time in so long. But I'd come far enough. Far enough, at least, to recover, as the French would say, my joie de vivre. And I had Lafayette to thank for it all. Just as at the start of the Revolution, this Frenchman was the lucky talisman who opened the way to a better future. As much as I desired it, I didn't need to see the wilds of the country to find my place in it. I already knew. I had my work to think of, and a city full of orphaned children who needed me.
"Bah," he said, seeing that my mind was set. "While I am gone, at least agree you will think on all I've said. Hamilton's story should be remembered. It should be told, and it should be written."
"A biography has been tried," I admitted, remembering how I was hampered before by Federalists and Republicans alike, how Reverend Mason's efforts ultimately came to nothing. "But too many of Alexander's letters are scattered, and too many people do not want his story told."
Lafayette's eyes narrowed a moment. "His foes oppose you?"
I chuckled a little bitterly. "With respect to his papers, it's his friends who have created the greatest obstacle." A few years earlier, just before he died, Nathaniel Pendleton confessed to stealing my husband's drafts of the farewell address and conspiring with fellow Federalists to keep the papers in trust and under seal, which was simply gracious language for keeping them from me. But I'd learned of this at the depths of my fury at Hamilton, and done nothing about it. Now, in defense of myself, I said, "I am refused even simple requests to see his papers."
"I think that I will not be refused. After all, you are the only person with the temerity to rebuff the guest of the nation."
I laughed, but also felt an ember of hope. "I don't rebuff you, General. It's only that I don't wish to give false hopes."
"I have been reproached all my life for giving in too much to my hopeful disposition, but one would never try anything extraordinary if one despaired of success."
"No, I suppose they wouldn't," I murmured, his words working their way into my heart.
"Then, my dear Mrs. Hamilton," he said, leaning close, "no longer despair."
Chapter 43. Spring, 1825. Harlem. The windowless attic didn't make for a majestic courtroom. The only light to be had was from lanterns I hung from the wooden rafters. The only witnesses, the spiders. Perhaps that was best, since pushing through the cobwebs of this place, and my memories, I alone would play judge and jury. And as for Hamilton, well, he would represent himself. He'd been a magnificent lawyer in life, but in death, the words he wrote would have to stand for him without addition or deletion or the animation of his voice or expression. And in seating myself before a trunk of letters, the personal ones, the painful ones, I prepared to review the evidence again. In the interest of justice, I told myself, nothing more. Because Lafayette was right. Alexander Hamilton deserved to be better remembered by his country. His story deserved to be written. But neither would happen unless I became his champion again. And I didn't know if he deserved that from me. Thus, I examined the first charge against him. Did my husband take my sister for his lover? I'd so often heard him argue in court that I could well imagine what he'd say. It hasn't been proven. What was the evidence, after all? There was no direct admission of guilt by either of them. Not in life, nor in death. The most damning thing, in the end, hadn't been the letters or tokens or gossip or befuddled utterances under the influence of laudanum. The most damning thing had been my husband's accounting book, which proved he paid Angelica's expenses and rented for her a mysterious apartment. And yet, if I took that for proof of an affair, must I not also note that except for that one visit, nothing like it ever appeared in his books before or after? If there had been an affair, if, Hamilton's voice echoed in my mind with pointed reminder. Yes, well, if my husband took my sister for a lover, the intimacy was most likely confined to that one visit when Angelica was estranged from church, when Hamilton was drunk on power, drunk enough to fall into bed with Maria Reynolds and pay a blackmailer besides. When he'd confessed that, I hadn't asked him if there were other women. And yet you said you forgave me everything. Hamilton's voice echoed again, and I glared at a dark corner of the attic where I could almost see him pacing, formulating his arguments. I had said that, hadn't I? It was just like him to remember a finer point. When, thinking we were dying of yellow fever, I might have insisted that he confess all his sins. But I hadn't demanded an accounting of his infidelities or vices, nor a listing of the things he said he'd done to imperil his soul. I'd merely accepted him, the whole of him, and forgiven. As if the yellow fever had burned us both clean of all our sins. Perhaps that's what he believed. What good would it have done, then, to confess something that would have destroyed my relationship with my sister, the strength of which was sometimes the only thing that kept me alive? And what if they were innocent? I slammed the account book shut and put it back into the trunk as the notion sent a trickle of sweat down my spine. I remembered my father once saying how vile a knave he would have considered himself if he were to have accused my mother and been wrong. It was entirely possible that Angelica's last words were only confused mutterings mixed with her determination in hiding her illness from me. Not an affair. Entirely possible that my sister kept tokens of a beloved brother-in-law, just as I'd kept tokens of beloved friends. What if I'd allowed my own heart to blacken against a loving sister and an innocent husband who had already been so unfairly slandered by others?
I'd forgive you anything, so long as you loved me,
Hamilton had once said to me. I did love him, for all the good it had done me. Maybe I'd even loved him enough to forgive the unforgivable. Because my sister was right to say that love was a thing beyond reason, even if it were a crime. Before we met, Hamilton loved a man named John Lawrence. But that was not the crime with which I charged him. Instead, I asked, did Hamilton love me? In the heat of our courtship, when I suggested eloping, Hamilton claimed to worry he'd be thought a self-seeking, fortune-hunting seducer, angling for advantage. Was that really what he was, in the end? I remembered with a start that the girl I was then had decided to love him, even if he were all those things, and that it was Hamilton who insisted it must all be done right. Hamilton who risked losing the fortune he told John Lawrence he was after. The fortune I represented, if that was his aim. I pulled from the trunk the bundle of letters more yellowed and faded with age than the first time I had read them more than 10 years earlier. Touching that dark lock of hair belonging to the South Carolinian gentleman who'd haunted my life seemed to unlatch my sanity a bit. Or perhaps it was merely the heat rising to the attic and addling my senses. Whatever the cause, the next words I spoke aloud. Well, Mr. Hamilton, your friend Lafayette has offered you a defense. Let us see what you have to say for yourself. Straightening my spine and taking a deep, bracing breath, I unfolded the pages. I'd committed the painful words to memory, but was determined to give them a just reading. Next fall completes my doom. I give up my liberty to Miss Schuyler. She is a good-hearted girl who, I am sure, will never play the termagant. Though not a genius, she has good sense enough to be agreeable, and though not a beauty, she has fine black eyes, is rather handsome, and has every other requisite of the exterior to make a lover happy. That was as far as my heart had been able to see through my tears when I first read this letter. But now I noticed the next line. And believe me, I am a lover in earnest. I noticed the date on this letter and the ones before it, too. How curious that Hamilton should have waited 4 months to tell his friend that he was to marry. As if jilting a sweetheart. One didn't, after all, praise a new lover to the one being replaced. One deprecated, made light of the new infatuation. And Lawrence begged my husband not to withdraw from him the consolation of his letters. Perhaps he understood it was an ending. How to balance this against all the letters Hamilton sent me? Since I didn't have a scale, I read them again. All of them. Even the one I tore to bits 10 years before in rage and anger and grief. I'd ripped apart the sonnet he wrote me in Morristown, Hamilton's first declaration of love. I'd torn it up, but tellingly, I suppose, I'd kept the pieces. Now, with a needle and thread, I sewed the fragile words back together. And with each stitch, I felt closer and closer to binding the wound. My eyes swam with tears as I read the reassembled lines. Before no mortal ever knew a love like mine so tender, true. Did you mean it, Alexander? I asked myself as I pierced the final scrap of paper with the needle's tip. Did you truly love? Dear God, the indignity of being interrogated after death. Whatever else might come of this trial, I decided that I would never leave my own letters behind to be cross-examined and vivisected. Like the corpses in the bloody doctor's riot so many years ago. Like Alexander's motives, investigated by several inquests in the whole country. And by me. Which brought me to the third charge. The one I scarcely allowed myself to acknowledge. Was the duel with Burr a fight for the nation? A vainglorious exercise in futility, or something worse? One last suicidal chariot ride across the sky? I'd read the witness accounts. I knew both men. I'd even seen Burr recently, 2 years ago, when by happenstance he slunk onto a ferry just as I was getting off, and the anxious crowd parted so we were face to face, leaving me to stare into those eyes in search of the truth. But seeing only the pathetic emptiness of his soul, I'd left Burr with a withering glare and without answers. For there was nothing Burr could say to right one single wrong between us. So maybe I could never know what Alexander intended that day at Weehawken. because the people we love are not entirely knowable, even to themselves. But we love them anyway. The only other choice is to live without love, alone. What then is the verdict? The spiders seemed to ask, as if they were weaving a web of memories around me. Studying the patchwork sonnet now repaired in my lap and my wedding ring beside it, I didn't know what the verdict was. A judge and jury must deliberate after all, so I adjourned the court. And the place I deliberated was in my garden, where I gathered the last blooms of purple hyacinths. But a verdict was finally forced upon me by a calling card, and by James Monroe. Chapter 44. Monroe is standing in my parlor at the Grange, and everything, my whole life it seems, comes full circle. I should have expected it. Monroe is, after all, not so much a visitor as a closing argument. I find that the lapse of time brings its softening influences, Monroe is saying in that deceptively sweet southern accent. Now we are both nearing the grave, when past differences can be forgiven and forgotten. Forgiven and forgotten, he says. And my eyes drift to the dappled light of the entryway, where a bust of my husband has sat for more than 20 years. I've put Hamilton on trial. And now, here in the flesh, stands one of my husband's many enemies and accusers. I remember a time, Mrs. Hamilton, when we counted one another as friends. Monroe continues wistfully, as if he is remembering. And of course I am remembering, too. Remembering with a bittersweet pang how we met, the friendship we shared in war, in peace, over games of backgammon and sightseeing in Philadelphia with our young families while building a new world. But I remember also that James Monroe was a man who gave me his word of honor and broke it. A man who hurt me and exposed me to humiliation. He isn't the only person I've cared about who betrayed me. There have been so many others. But he's the only one I can face now. And so I do, using my silence as a weapon, forcing him to continue speaking until he finds the words that might reach me. Because as I once said to Monroe, life, like backgammon, is a game of perseverance in which you're forced to choose the best move, even if it is only a choice between evils. I face such a choice now. Despite our differences, I've tried to look after your sons, Monroe says. Alex, he means. He named my son a U.S. attorney and a land commissioner, and I ought to be grateful. My sons are grateful. James especially has found a way to ingratiate himself with the Republicans. All James had to do was say that his father's policies were wrong and pretend it was the Jeffersonians instead of the Hamiltonians who brought this government into being. Perhaps I could pretend too. Accepting this lie and making amends would raise the stature of our family. Perhaps I would even be considered a stateswoman for reconciling with Monroe. After all, they say that in the end, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson made friends again. And that was after having savaged one another in a presidential election. So, in truth, there is no good reason to hold myself aloof from Monroe anymore. Not when the man has come to my house, hat in hand. And I soften a little, remembering a time when Monroe offered me comfort and compassion, when I desperately needed both. I remember, too, what he said in defense of himself when I blamed him for exposing me to the Reynolds scandal.
It was the scoundrel to whom you pledged your troth who exposed you to this, not me.
That is the plain truth at the bottom of it. I know this now better than I knew it then. But when offering comfort, he also said,
You are a kind, lovely, and charming woman, and you deserve much better than—
I cut him off then, because he was going to say that I deserved better than Alexander Hamilton. Monroe was going to say that I ought to have married someone like him, a gentleman of honor born on the right side of the blanket. Monroe thought he was the better man. No doubt he thinks it still. That is why he's standing here now in my parlor, offering what might pass to the uninitiated political novice as an olive branch. He's still trying to prove that he's the better man. But he's not offered an apology, and he owes one. Not just to me, but to the country. This is, after all, a man who was president of a nation he never wished to come into being. Monroe had opposed the Constitution, and he'd helped Jefferson oppose damned near everything else, the debt, the bank, the Jay Treaty, and a standing army that would have prevented the nation's capital from being burned to the ground. In short, James Monroe set himself against nearly every good measure bound to bring about the more perfect union of which he was now considered a founder. That he was a true hero in the Revolutionary War, I will never deny. That he finally came round to seeing good sense in some matters, I will grant. I can even give grudging admiration for his political genius in wrapping himself in the flag in an attempt to prevent the nation's disunion. But James Monroe is not now and never was the better man. None of them were. Not Jefferson, not Adams, not Burr, not Madison, not Monroe. And for him to speak of our differences, as if, instead of taking opposite sides in great moral questions, we'd all merely quarreled about how many lumps of sugar to take in tea. Oh no. If Alexander had lived, he'd have never let that stand. He'd have challenged Monroe just as he challenged me, and everyone else every day of his life. And I am a better person for it. I live in a better world because of Alexander Hamilton, and so do we all. It's the promise he fulfilled while other men took credit for it. Men like Monroe. I see all of them in Monroe's gray eyes. Jefferson, Burr, Adams. Every man who spread lies about us or tried to climb up a bloody ladder of political power, the rungs of which were made from my family's bones. Which is why I won't surrender. They cannot have my country. They cannot have my flag, and they cannot have my dear Hamilton. He was mine, even if he was not only mine. Just like the country and the flag. They don't belong to anyone else to define as they please without my say. Neither does Hamilton. I will not politely agree to lies about my husband's legacy and call it history. A marriage is like a union of states, requiring countless dinner table bargains to hold it together. There may be irreconcilable differences brewing below the surface that can come to open rupture. And there is, in a marriage, as in a nation, a certain amount of storytelling we do to make it understood. Even if those stories we tell to make our marriage or country work don't paint the whole picture, they're still true. But to leave Alexander Hamilton out of the painting entirely is a lie. I know the truth, which is why I realize now, or perhaps I've known it all along and been too proud to admit it, that whatever secrets my husband kept were born from fear of losing me. He loved me. Doubt thou the stars are fire, doubt that the sun doth move, doubt truth to be a liar, but never doubt I love. A verdict, at last, and I am, at long last, ready to deliver it. Mr. Monroe, I finally say, my voice clear, cold, and resolved, my spine straight as an Indian arrow. If you've come to tell me you repent, that you're sorry, very sorry for the misrepresentations and slanders you circulated against my dear husband, if you've come to say this, I understand. But otherwise, no lapse of time, no nearness to the grave makes any difference. Monroe blinks, plainly stunned. But I rejoice at the truth of my words. No lapse of time, no nearness to the grave or distance from it makes any difference. For I find inside myself love where I'd not expected it to be, both for a flawed nation and a flawed man. Love, a thing so powerful it can overcome the divide of time and death. It's still there inside me, like an eternal flame, though the light it casts is different now. As Monroe strides out of the room without another word, much less an apology, I realize I've been asking the wrong question and examining the wrong evidence. I've asked myself who Alexander Hamilton was. I ought to have asked who I am. And now I know. I am a Schuyler, semper fidelis, always faithful, always loyal, and I will never again let my dear Hamilton be forgotten. Epilogue. March, 1837, on the Ohio River. Hamilton always did have to have the last word. And so it seems do I. For the past decade, I've fought to make sure my husband isn't written out of the history of the country he helped found. I've fought and won. In the end, I filed a lawsuit to retrieve the papers Nathaniel Pendleton stole from me and the Federalists tried to keep from ever seeing the light of day. Drafts of President Washington's farewell address in Alexander's hand that proved his authorship. And seeing those old scribblings, the notes we made together, I was overcome with emotions. For that address defined what this nation is, has been, and what it shall ever be. It also defined us, Alexander and me. Sitting together, matching wits as partners and patriots and parents, seeking to build a better future for our children and their children, too. I'm gratified now that I've finally held Alexander's biography in my own hands. The first volume, anyway. Written by my son, Johnny. The whole work will be long, wordy, thorough, and in multiple parts. Just as it should be. Having shouldered the great weight of it for more than 3 decades, I feel as though I can finally take a deep breath. And now, like more and more of my countrymen, I am westward bound. I may not have a long time remaining, but I resolve to see as much of this country as I can, and set one last matter to right. With both triumph and trepidation, I travel with Lisbeth and her husband, Sidney Augustus Holly, the curly-haired customs inspector she met at Lafayette's ball. He's not a man of great means, but their happiness together is evident, which is why I gave my blessing. And they both wish to accompany me partly out of curiosity and desire for adventure, and partly because my children feel the need to chaperone me at 80 years old, as if I haven't outlived nearly everyone I once knew, including my enemies. Monroe passed away only a few years after our final reckoning. A heart ailment, they say. Destitute and alone, Aaron Burr died with a grimace. His death mask is kept as an object of amusement in a museum that brags of the busts, casts, and skulls, human and animal, of some of the most distinguished men that ever lived, along with those of pirates, robbers, and murderers. I know the category to which Burr belongs. Yes, I have outlived them all. Even Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, the Jacobin and the madman, who saw fit to die on the very same day, and upon the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence at that. In his eulogy for them, Daniel Webster said that no 2 men had given a more lasting direction to our country. Webster was then and remains now, quite simply, wrong. I give credit to Jefferson for the power of his declaration. Even I can grant him that. and there is an argument to be made that we'd never have declared our independence at all without Adams. But otherwise, the two men who most shaped America did not die together on the 50th anniversary of that heralded declaration. One died nearly 33 years ago, and the other survived until just recently. Alexander Hamilton and James